All right, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Hero Bells podcast, and this is episode 29. If you aren't following me on Instagram, you really should be, because that's where you're going to get all sorts of workouts and inspiration, I suppose. Although I'm going to be honest with you, that content is going to change because, well, to be honest with you, I don't really believe that it's helping anybody. It looks a lot like, I know this is a terrible self-promotion, but I think it's good and useful, but I don't think I'm getting the idea across that it's differentiating from anything else. And even though I think what I have to say does, and the point of view that I, that I come from, is coming from a unique place, but I have to show that. And I don't think you guys are getting that quite with my workouts I just ate dinner. I had some Indian food that my wife made. She's not Indian, but so maybe it doesn't count. Maybe that's a racist food. Maybe it's cultural appropriation. Maybe I made Indian-inspired food. I don't know. But either way, I'm going to be changing that content and making it even better and more digestible. And I find that if most of the information is out there and available, it doesn't matter so much about the information, but at the level at which I can explain it so that people can get it and people can absorb it and use it. That's what I want. That's what I think most people want. And I guess they want it to look good or something like that too. But, you know, all that shirt off kind of sex selling bullshit, that's going to stop. Because, well, that has unintended and unwanted consequences. But, so if you're not following me on there, you should be, because I definitely put out content on there that you're going to like at some point, and my stories, people seem to like those, and of course I posted parts of this podcast on there. I'm on, Instagram, at @hero_kbells. I'm on Facebook, where you can get supplementary material to these podcasts, at @hero_kbells. How embarrassing. And you can also find this on YouTube with a whole bunch of other video content to help you be your best in terms of starting out. Starting out seems to be the hardest part for a lot of people, or even just starting back up and knowing where to begin and what you can do. So I have a challenge on there that I believe is 40 days. And there's a reason why it's 40 days. And the reason that it's 40 days is because that's roughly around the time it takes for you to start a habit. And all of these exercises that I'm doing, you can break them down and modify them. And I make it pretty damn easy. There's some where you're only doing 5 reps of something a day. But I guarantee you, even when I was doing that challenge, and I was already in pretty good shape, I got even better just by doing these little extras. So I highly suggest you do that. Check that out. I did a vlog. I don't know if I'm going to do that again, to be honest with you. I thought I was going to, but I'm not sure. But anyways, this is a long-winded intro or promo, plug, whatever you want to call it. If you notice, the audio quality has changed a little bit. I am recording this in a closet. That's right. You might be able to hear the whirring of my computer, and perhaps a neighbor or two, maybe a dog. I do live in an apartment building with paper-thin walls, so I apologize if that does come up. Anyway, today's podcast is How to Be Confident, and I'm reading from the book The Psychology of Performance by Eddie O'Connor. that's not something he says, but it seems to be something that snotty doctors say. Fuck them. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit about my life and how I relate to this book, The Psychology of Performance. I'm going to read for you. I'm probably going to have to break this up because it looks like I've done quite a bit here. And just one quick side note, I apologize that I haven't been putting out content on every Wednesday for these podcasts, but I definitely needed that time. And so I apologize that you weren't satisfied for the all 10 of you that are listening. I'm kidding. There's actually a bunch more, and I do value you. But I needed to do that for very, very personal reasons. And I'm glad I did. And so I'm sorry, but not sorry. Anyway, when I was growing up, I grew in large part without my dad. I had my brother and collected father figures throughout, from my friends. But I never had someone concrete, someone strong to look up to. And even worse than that, I was surrounded by women. And I say worse only because growing up as a boy, growing up around women is where most of your influence is female. Makes things very confusing. Just take it from me. I'm sure there's maybe women that are listening to this and going, oh my God, and you don't know what my life was like. But it made it very, very weird. And not sexually either, but just weird. Because I became very, I suppose it's a good thing, but I became very empathetic. I was easy to get along with. And I wasn't combative. I didn't really like confrontation in terms of like physical confrontation. I also didn't have any skills to be able to deal with it. But I had my mother and my two sisters and then my brother. But my brother was, he kind of had the same problem. He didn't really have his dad either and had his two sisters, which are my two sisters, really, and my mom being his main peers other than his friends. And needless to say, myself and my brother were both pretty sensitive people. I think as a result of that. That's my appraisal, but I don't know. Anyways, they were all strong women to give them their due because I would never fuck with my sisters ever or my mom. My mom and my sisters were seriously, they were fighters. It was freaky weird. I remember when I was young, my mom picked me up from elementary school and someone, I don't know what happened because of course, I was little. My mom picked me up from school, and I remember getting in and being embarrassed. And then she goes and gives this woman the finger while she's driving and leaving the parking lot, still giving the finger and honking her horn. That was one of the more embarrassing things I remember from being a little kid. But that just tells you the type of fight that was in my mom. My mom really didn't care what anybody thought. And sometimes to her detriment, of course, and obviously mine. But as an 8-year-old boy with so much energy and potential, I didn't really have anyone that knew how to handle me and channel my level of output. That's something that I think would have been perfect for my dad if he was around. I went for several things to cope with this, like contact sports. So when I was 13, I played football, and I mean gridiron American football, which actually was invented in Canada, FYI, or hockey. I played street hockey with my buddies and we'd put on gloves and helmets and beat the shit out of each other. That was fun. But really what I actually liked, because I wasn't really good at teams, I liked martial arts, but my mom couldn't afford it and there wasn't really anything cool like there is now. It was mostly like, you gotta go learn kung fu and, throw around fake swords and pretend you're a ninja. It was really stupid. And even if she could, she wouldn't know how to relate like a man or a boy would. She just wasn't like that. My mom was very sensitive in some ways and a staunch feminist. So anything that was very male, she didn't know how to handle. But she knew that I liked it, and that was about it. That's all that was good. It was good enough for her because I loved it. I love my mom for that. But I had no male role models at the time other than my brother, but my brother was fucked up too. So when conflict inevitably rose, I would freeze, almost like a coward. But I knew that this wasn't the case. I was plenty confident in other areas, just not in dealing with conflict with men. I was great at communicating with women. I found that I didn't have the confidence to stand up or to get hurt. You kind of have to be able to sacrifice and know that if you're going to get into a conflict that you could get hurt. And to be judicious with that, or be fairly carefree, but I wasn't. I knew there was a good chance I'd get hurt or embarrassed, and that was terrible. So in some ways, I was a coward, but I also just didn't go looking for trouble either. I also had an incident when I was 11 that changed my behavior with fighting forever. I was a bully, believe it or not, for a couple of years. And I'm not proud of it. I wasn't horrible. I wasn't going around, like I said, looking for trouble. The people that I hurt, and I wish I could apologize to them, but I don't think I was doing anything. I felt at the time it was retribution. These weren't just random kids, like little puny kids that I was just picking on. I mean, I was an average size kid. I wasn't big or small. And it wasn't necessarily a self-esteem issue, but the people that I hurt were actually former friends and people that abandoned me. And I used to just, you know, this was when I was much younger, of course, but as I grew older, I stopped looking for conflict at all. And one day I got in a fight and I lost badly. I got punched in the temple and briefly knocked out. I never wanted to feel that way again, so I just kind of cowered in a way. I just avoided, I would say would be a better word, maybe to save my ego. Ever since that day, though, I sought redemption. And I always fell flat until I got into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which was only a few years ago. And I haven't been doing it since I've been in Spain. But even there, I barely fit in. But I had my friends, nonetheless, on the mats. I came in very unconfident, but brimming with bravado. And I was humbled quickly. And I began to learn how to fight and increase my confidence. So much so that I still managed to put myself in a ring with someone who is a seasoned boxer and get two black eyes and a busted up nose. That's how, maybe that's stupid, I don't know. But I was humbled quickly. And it mostly worked, but I still had this problem I couldn't describe. I needed to know where confidence came from. And this is something that I've actually been trying to work on for the past few years. It's not that I'm unconfident. It's that, how about this? If there were some sort of fight that were to take place where I had to act, I wouldn't know what to do. And I'd be afraid of my monkey gene shadow side coming out and someone getting seriously hurt. Myself or the other person. Or both. And that's, I would love to be able to be in a position where I could be, I know most people who do know how to fight are probably thinking I'm an idiot, but I would like to know with some sort of certainty where my feet would even be, with some sort of confidence that I knew what I was doing and I could somewhat predict an outcome in that either, well, I know I can run away. I'm actually a pretty fast sprinter. And I know that I'm strong. I know I can hurt somebody, but everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And that's kind of, I think, maybe a base denominator, lowest denominator for men is confidence with conflict. So I started to read this chapter in the book, and then actually I kind of stopped partway through. So we're going to explore this together. Because I thought this was so useful, I couldn't even contain myself. And I wanted to pass it on to you. So here I am now. Every once in a while I might burp or something, so not into the microphone, that'd be gross. But I just had dinner and holy fuck. This is Eddie O'Connor speaking in his book. Confidence can be very powerful. When you believe that you can do something or pursue it with more vigor, focus, and drive. On the other hand, when you lack confidence, you avoid difficult goals, give less effort, and give up more easily. It sounds somewhat familiar, but maybe I'm more confident than I thought. In this lecture, you'll learn how confidence empowers you to be your best and take action, as well as how self-talk, in quotes, affects confidence. We all know confidence when we see it, but it can be more difficult to define. In fact, the literature in sports psychology will often interchangeably use the terms self-confidence and self-efficacy. Okay, so we're going to get a little background story here. Self-efficacy, so that's being effective with yourself, as a theory was first coined in 1977 by Albert Bandura, who defined it as an individual's belief in one's capabilities to organize and execute the courses of action required to get the desired results. So that's kind of what I was talking about. If I were to get into some sort of conflict, I would want to make sure that I had some sort of predictive pattern, not just chaos. At least on my end, I want to know what my plan is. I don't fucking have one. So if any of that happens, I'm going pure gorilla on somebody and I'm going to smash them. That's all I'm thinking of. Maybe not with my fist. Maybe I throw them. Maybe I put their head through a car window. I don't know. Something horrible. I don't want to do that. I want to know that if I throw this left hook and I knock this person out or I hit them in the bread basket and they get winded, that's my chance to, yeah, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know how that shit works. But I just feel that that's kind of an element of confidence that I don't have, and I really don't like that I don't have it. Anyway, back to the book. Sports confidence is the degree of certainty individuals possess about their capability to be successful in sport. So it is more general and focused on the result, as opposed to the abilities necessary to achieve the result, as in self-efficacy. So self-efficacy is the ability necessary to achieve the result. Sports confidence is the degree of certainty. So that gives you two sides of the same coin in terms of confidence. So sports confidence is the degree of certainty, and self-efficacy is the focus of the abilities to achieve the result. Okay? So back to the book. Both involve a cognitive process where we make judgments about our ability to accomplish a particular goal. In both, we are talking about a self-concept. Oh my goodness. My computer is doing something weird. Holy shit. I have a ghost in my computer. Or I'm being watched by the NSA. They don't want me to have self-confidence. This guy knows too much. Can't read this book. Sorry about that. I have no idea what's going on. My pages keep scrolling. Okay. Back to the book. Sorry about that. Both involve a cognitive process where we make judgments about our ability to accomplish a particular goal. In both, we are talking about a self-concept within a goal-striving framework about what we can do, not about attributes we may possess or good feelings about ourselves. So it's not, you know, the warm and fuzzies where you're like, I'm just so great. No. Both self-efficacy and sport confidence are goal-oriented. Self-efficacy beliefs can vary in level, strength, and generality. Self-efficacy level refers to the confidence someone has in his or her ability to perform in various challenging tasks. You generally need a higher level of self-efficacy to believe you can succeed more difficult tasks. Now, I did a podcast before on flow, and this kind of talks about, there was a graph, and you can find this on the Facebook page, where it talks about you need to have a certain level of skill in order to be in these flow states. And I think this is kind of entangled with confidence. So you get people at high-level sports or extreme sports, if they didn't have the ability to do what they do, for instance, like, say, a dirt biker or a skydiver, if you don't have those skills, well, your confidence is going to be pretty fucking low, to say the least. So anyway, back to the book. Self-efficacy strength is the degree of confidence a person has in his or her abilities. We know or believe things 100%. That's pretty powerful. So if you know you're in your skills, what you can do, and then you believe it, that's a sign of self-efficacy. And it's a degree of confidence. It still sounds kind of confusing, doesn't it? Anyway, self-efficacy generally refers to how much of this set of beliefs can be applied to a range of activities or conditions. One athlete may feel that he or she can succeed in all athletic challenges. Another may be confident in racket sports, but not endurance events or ball handling games. And still another may be confident only in tennis. So for me, what am I super confident with? Kettlebells. I'm pretty confident with that. I can visualize it. I know I can perform at least the basics. Pretty damn good. I would say about 90% because people screw up. But I can visualize it 200% at the very least and believe that I'm going to do it 100%. Greater beliefs people have in their own capabilities consistently predict improved performance and an accomplishment across numerous life situations, including in sports, education, and the workplace. That's useful. So you can take that into your work. If you don't feel confident in what you're doing, and you don't have that self-efficacy, that belief in your abilities, then you might be screwed when you're asking for that raise or you take on that new job when you say, hey, boss, I can do this. Well, maybe you can't. But it's good to know. It's still good to believe, and you should pump yourself up, but do a gut check too. So it's not so much that beliefs have a direct impact on performance, although they do through their influence on behavior. It's just that beliefs alone don't make anything happen. Efficacy beliefs have powerful indirect effects too. Your self-efficacy beliefs influence what you choose to do. They influence the goals you choose to pursue, the level of activity they are, and the effort you put into achieving them. The higher your... The higher your belief in your own self-efficacy, the more challenging your goal will be and the more you will persist in the face of adversity. So if you know what you're doing, or at least you believe that you know what you're doing to a reasonable degree, you know, if you've never done, never used kettlebells, I see this all the time online, people who are personal trainers and not, they've never done a kettlebell course, and then I see their videos and what they're doing and putting out content with kettlebells, especially with the clean. It seems to be that a lot of personal trainers will do videos where they're doing a clean and it is so blatantly terrible that they've never taken an actual course on how to do it. They just assume that they need to get the bell up into, you know, near chest level. It varies too. I've seen people, well, they're literally will be almost in a goblet position, but with one hand, or they'll be way outside of their arm or too high and they get it all mixed up. They haven't figured these things out and they assume, well, I suppose it's fair. It's fair game. If people believe they know what they're doing, then to them, they know what they're doing. But to those who are educated, you can spot it a mile away. I'm sure there's things I've done in my videos where people have thought the same thing. So I have to be fair on that one because sometimes I do things that I think I know how to do and I don't. But I see it a lot with personal trainers instead of the opposite. I will see kettlebell instructors typically stay in their lane like I tend to. I think the only thing I've really gone out of bounds on, what was it? Mobility. Mobility is not my forte. Even though it's something I do, it's not something I teach because I don't do it confidently. I have enough issues. Anyway, I went a little off the rails here. Where were we? Commitment rises with self-efficacy. On the flip side, if you lack confidence, you're more likely to avoid the task, even if objectively you can do it. I think everyone feels that way in their everyday life. So you have to, no matter what, you kind of have to believe you can do it, especially if you can visualize yourself doing it. So for instance, a small one for me, what's a small one? Okay, how about this? Social anxiety. I get social anxiety. I have it. I just do. And I go into a bar where there's tons of people and I can't move anywhere or I have to really push through people to get to, you know, just to go take a piss or something like that. That freaks me out. And however, if I go into it or before I go into it and I kind of coach myself through it, which yes, I do, then and I visualize what I'm going to do because especially if it's a bar that I know. That's typically what I do is I'll go to bars that I know. And not ones that necessarily that I know, but it's more like, I've seen the inside. I know what it looks like. And that the reason for that is, for visualization, not because I'm afraid to go into a new bar. It's not like there's some imaginary force field or where I have social anxiety that bad, but nonetheless, that really helps. And then, of course, I believe, I'm like, oh, Kyle, you can do this. Of course you can do this. And I typically do. And then I just realize that all I'm doing is just stuffed into a place with like a sardine. And I just, it's annoying for its own sake, not because I'm anxious. So your self-efficacy beliefs influence how you interpret the world around you and what happens to you. When you're confident, you tend to interpret tasks as challenging rather than threatening. And you are more optimistic and less likely to expect a negative outcome, and will have fewer negative emotions when performing tasks. Sounds about right. That rapid heart rate and jittery feeling can be either excitement that will help you when you're confident, or nervousness that will interfere with performance when self-efficacy is low. When things go wrong, confidence serves as a cognitive buffer, limiting the damaging effects. Whoa, Ghost is back in the computer. Holy shit, what is going on here? Okay. I'm going to leave that there for a second, see what happens. I wish I had like some cool interlude music or something like that. And it was like, doop-doop-doop. And just take an intermission for a second, let my computer get into 2020. Anyways, when things do go wrong, confidence serves as a cognitive buffer, limiting the damaging effects of negative self-talk and negative emotions that can follow. For example, when confident individuals fail, they're more likely to attribute it to a lack of effort. So if you listen to, I'm going to take a little side note here, another one. There's another podcast that I did called Mindset. And I read from the book Mindset by Carol Dweck. Dr. Carol Dweck, my bad. Sorry, Dr. Carol Dweck. And they talk about the growth mindset, or she talks about the growth mindset and says you're in the face of failure. That's really when your attitude comes out of whether you have a static mindset or a growth mindset. And so the static mindset would be more thinking, instead of that it was a lack of effort on your own part, someone who has a static mindset will often just blame somebody else and other things. But anyways, back to the book, something they can control and fix the next time rather than shortcoming in their ability. So I'm going to read that sentence over again because I literally went into half of it. For example, when confident individuals fail, they're more likely to attribute it to a lack of effort, which is something they can control and fix the next time, rather than a shortcoming in their ability. Even if criticized, confident individuals have a better ability to brush off those comments and not take them to heart, whereas those lacking confidence can internalize these beliefs and damage their sense of self. Been there, done that, where somebody will say something about me, and it was just the right place and the right time and the right word, where I'm just like, I'll just hang on to it, and I'm like, My biceps are small. Fuck you. I'll say something like that. And, or, you know, that's just kind of how it affects me. I don't know if I necessarily have that internal monologue. That'd be kind of weird. But you can imagine it in like maybe some 80s terrible movie. But that's sort of what happens. It'll be a seed of hate, and it'll grow. And the person might not even have meant it to be that bad. And it was just that bad. And it kept growing and festering, adding to the lack of confidence. So it's real. Back to the book. For these reasons, confidence is a significant factor in performance excellence. So we better know how to build it. Albert Bandura, or Bandura, identified four sources of self-efficacy: mastery experiences or past accomplishments, vicarious experiences or modeling, verbal persuasion, and physiological and affective states. So we're going to break that down. That's a whole bunch of word salad, to quote Rogan. That's a great expression. So these are the four sources of self-efficacy: mastery experiences or past accomplishments. So it's something that you know how to do, you've mastered it, like breathing, or past accomplishments, also like breathing, but maybe it's reading Harry Potter. You know you have the ability to read Harry Potter books at that level, which I think is a grade 8 level. Vicarious experiences, and I believe that is living through somebody else, or modeling. So you, of course, you're modeling somebody else's experience. Verbal persuasion. So obviously that's somebody talking to you or you talking to yourself, and physiological and affective states. So that's the one where I don't know if I can get it right from the word. So let's go through this and break it down. Oh, I figured out why this is doing this. I'm a numbnuts. Anyways, the most powerful of these states are mastery experiences, a person's perception about what he or she has accomplished in the past. Nothing is more powerful than the actual experience of success to boost self-efficacy. There's something about the objective and the experiential feeling of doing it right. So we want to maximize these mastery experiences in all settings to increase confidence. We do that by creating task-involving climates where the focus is on personal improvement, comparison to where you were before, and how you are getting better from there. I'm starting to realize this is an information overload of a podcast. So let's just see, where are we at in this one? Because I think I'm going to have to break this up. Yeah, we're already at a half hour. So if you guys like it short, then I can make it short, but I'm not going to make it. I'm going to get it a little bit longer. Okay, here, where were we? Oh, son of a bitch computer. There's something about the objective and experiential feeling of doing it right, so we want to maximize these mastery experiences in all settings to increase confidence. We do that by creating task-involving climates where the focus is on personal improvement, comparison to where you were before, and how you are getting better from there. Vicarious experiences, or modeling, can be a good source of information to increase efficacy, also called social modeling. When we see someone else succeed, especially when that person is similar to you in age, gender, or experience, your confidence increases through their success. Cognitive self-modeling or mental imagery is another way to increase confidence. Ooh, I've done this myself. So, for me, when I started jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, not Japanese sort of weird traditional style. I don't even know what I'm talking about on that level, but when I was doing jiu-jitsu, I noticed that I favored a certain style of playing. I did it just naturally. I wasn't trying to do it. And so I started watching athletes that played the same way. And through them, I actually found that I was incredibly confident. So there's a few guys where they do, well, there's tons of them, but where they do flying moves, which means you're essentially jumping at your opponent and putting this putting a move on somebody at a very rapid rate and using the element of surprise to your advantage. That's something that I found was easy to do in terms of deception, which Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is a lot of deception. And of course, body positioning and a million other factors, it's an onion that just keeps peeling. But I've done that. So I've had vicarious experiences. And of course, when I saw these people being my age and winning and doing all that, they're very much like me, I felt successful. And I went and emulated what they did to a degree. And it was successful at that too. I'm sorry, my dinner is just like giving me the craziest burps. Verbal persuasion is when someone else has confidence in us and expresses that. So that's somebody else telling you you're great. This helps, especially if that person is knowledgeable or someone we trust. And I mean really trust. So for me, I could have, I don't know, my mom, my wife, my friends tell me I'm great at jiu-jitsu. But if my coach tells me I'm great at jiu-jitsu, way better. Because, you know, when you're a kid and you're like, Mom, you know, I'm scared to do this, or I suck at that. And they go, no, honey, you're amazing. I mean, your mom's going to tell you exactly what moms tell you. That's why there's the expression, my mom tells me I'm handsome or smart or whatever. Because it doesn't really mean much in the real world. You're just awesome to her. And so, maybe for some, that's good. For me, it's good, but not the be-all, end-all when it comes to jiu-jitsu. That's for sure. So for such communications to be effective, they have to be within realistic bounds. Verbal persuasion after mistakes can build confidence if the communication is teaching and encouraging improvement of the things that can go better. I'll say it again. Verbal persuasion after mistakes can build confidence if the communication is teaching and encouraging improvement of the things that can go better. So if you, well, let's see, what's something that's relatable to everybody. Let's just go with gridiron football or soccer football, European football or actual football. Sorry, Americans, but I think they own that term. I think so. Living in Europe makes me really think they kind of own the term football. But anyway, with gridiron football, you're throwing a pigskin around. Say you can only throw 20 yards. And you were supposed to throw 25, and the person didn't catch it. It instead hit their feet, the receiver's feet. And, of course, you have an incomplete pass. You would have a coach say to you that you can do it, and you're great, but you can do it. All you need to do is throw it another 5 yards or some such bullshit. But nonetheless, you need that person. You might need that person to give you that sort of persuasion and give you the confidence to know that you can believe it, because you know that they can also do it. And it definitely helps with that. So anyway, that might have been a terrible example, but that's the best I can think of. And the same goes for soccer or football. Is that, you know, it's just a pass or a goal that you could have made or a save. You know, you're going to be coached into ways that they know you can do the required adjustment. But anyway, back to the book. The way we interpret our physiological condition and emotional states influences our self-efficacy. So if you think you're a big, fat, ugly mess, you're probably not going to be very confident. And therefore, you're probably going to feel bad about yourself, and that's a whole bunch of negative emotion. So naturally, your ability to be effective as, you know, for yourself is going to be pretty damn low. When our bodies and minds feel good, our confidence is elevated. When we feel pain, fatigue, or nervousness, or lack of motivation, our self-efficacy tends to diminish. Athletes should learn relaxation strategies and practice under anxious conditions to improve their confidence about how well they can perform when their arousal is increased. I love that word, arousal. I don't know why. That's a weird word. So, learning relaxation. That's a tough one because some people are just redlining all the time, especially athletes that are broke and they're like championship level. They might have bad knees or something and they can't relax. They have to keep working. They have to keep going and going and going and going and going and going. Eventually, it could breed this negative emotional state and you need to learn how to relax. So you might be at the top of the food chain, have some confidence, take a deep breath, and maybe get some sleep, learn to stretch, all those kinds of things. I'm going to be doing guided meditations very soon on here, by the way, for different things. So, and I'm kind of experimenting with the meditation thing myself right now. I've done it a million times before, and I know that it decreases my stress and neuroticism, which I'm actually quite neurotic. I don't know why. But nonetheless, this is to help with people with exercise. So for me, and I'm teaching kettlebells all the time, I need people to relax in a certain respect. Not obviously while they're exercising, but if they're training hard, you need to know how to relax and when to cut it short. There's a whole bunch of, you know, get after it, don't stop kind of people spouting a bunch of shit online. And you know what? They're partly right. You need to keep going and going and going and going. But there's a time where your body's just going to break. It just will. And you have to find out where that limit is, I think. I think that's really the reality of it. It's not so much that you want to just burn yourself out, but you have to find out where the limit is. And for me, this year, I burnt myself out. I went super hard and for a multitude of reasons. And most of them were, you know, I mean, it was well-intentioned. I certainly wasn't blind to the possibility of it happening. But one thing I didn't do well was relax and stretch and take the time I needed for myself, because I also didn't really have it. I had the time to sleep, but my sleep was interrupted because I was sore. I was sore because I didn't either do my mobility before I exercised, or I didn't stretch, didn't relax, and I certainly didn't meditate. I'm doing yoga and I'm meditating now on top of my training. I'm training better and I feel better every single time I train. Everything feels stronger. My emotional state is better. So what Dr. Eddie O'Connor is saying really rings true. It's so, to me, this theory that he was talking about from Albert, what was it? I forgot his name. What is it? Albert Bandura. I was going to say something else. I was going to say bottle in Spanish. I was going to say botella. That's not the right word. Anyway, in a sport context and beyond Bandura's four sources, four additional factors will help if athletes feel good about their physical selves, believe in their coach's abilities, feel comfortable in their competitive environment, and think the competitive situation is in their favor. Then they should have higher confidence in their ability to achieve success. So, I'm going to leave it for the next time. What these four additional beliefs are, and of course we're going to get into this where I'm only about halfway through what I've written and wanted to talk about, and of course the passage that I've chosen to read from. So, oh, you got to be fucking kidding me. Nope. Okay, good. I thought we lost the recording here. Yeah, this is Caveman Shit, everybody, so I hope you all like it, and I'm going to try to improve the quality very, very soon. I'm doing a lot of things differently, and I'm really excited that I'm going to be able to improve this podcast, improve my content, improve myself, and help improve you. So, to continue with this infomercial-sounding conclusion to episode 29, How to Build Self-Confidence, I'm going to tell you to go to Instagram, @hero_kbells, to get all sorts of content on there to help improve yourself, and go to Facebook to get the supplementary material for each episode, including this one, which will be available, well, I'm recording it on Monday, and this is going to be available on this coming Wednesday, which I think we're the 3rd. So it'll be the 5th. Not that this matters to you if you're listening to this now. But, so you can go and get the supplementary material on Facebook. And that's @HeroKBells. And of course, you can get this episode, all my other episodes, and tons of workouts, challenges, full workouts on YouTube. Just search Hero Bells and you'll find me. And please make sure you like, subscribe, turn notifications on, and be sure to sacrifice your firstborn to the gods, and that way I will become famous and make money from this podcast. Probably not. But maybe it'll work. Maybe you don't like your firstborn, and it's a win-win, right? Gods are happy, I'm happy, you're happy, child's not happy. That was a horrible thing to say. Anyway, so you can find me there, and stay tuned for episode... Wow, 30. I've done 30 episodes and not a single good one yet. I'm kidding. Anyway, thank you so much for listening, and talk to you next time. Have a good one.